from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, where in advance of coming down for Mardi Gras, the Northerners sent their weather for a day. But carnival season has begun very impolitely. And that's the good news. The spate of interviews that George W. Bush, President of the United States, think of that, gave prior to his inauguration, spun off a bunch of quotable observations. This one caught my eye last week, but I forgot to bring it in, and I did not want to let this pass because it clears up so much, ladies and gentlemen, and there's been so much speculation about this, and nothing beats a direct question and a direct answer for dealing with that. So in discussion with the Washington Post, the issue of Osama bin Laden came up. Now, mentioned here last week, the president and his spokespeople said during this pre-inauguration period, well, you know, there are things that he said that maybe he wouldn't say again, like dead or alive and things like that. So the Washington Post, in that context, asks a question. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the entire text of the question and the answer. The Post. Why do you think Osama bin Laden has not been caught? The president. Because he's hiding. You see, all these theories about the Pakistanis aren't helping, the Afghanis are this and things are that, and we diverted resources to Iraq. He's hiding. What do you expect? We're husbanding, I believe, what this implies is that we're husbanding our resources, not trying too hard to catch him right now. Because one of these days, ladies and gentlemen, he's going to come out of hiding, and that's when we get him. Glad we could clear that up. Hello, welcome to the show.
Too fast. Because as soon as I was lost, the next one in line took my head clean off. teeth of rustic gleam. The peaches snuggled closer down into the clotted cream. And for some unknown reason, my watch begins to chime. And though I beg and plead with you, you tell me it's not time. And though my face is smiling, I'm really feeling low. Though you sing with me, I know that it's not so.
From the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to yet another edition of the show for a week where we inaugurated a new president of the United States, and it's the same one as the last one. Isn't that wild? Before anything else, ladies and gentlemen, because I've been remiss in catching up on this, it is time for me to read the trades for you. It's a copyrighted feature. Don't worry about it. This first item will tell you why I have to hurry to get this on. From Advertising Age, White House Drug Office to Skip Super Bowl. I will read it for you. I have it right here. I'm reading it now. I'm just not reading it aloud yet. That comes next. Dateline Washington, the White House Drug Office will not debut one of its youth-targeted anti-drug ads on the Super Bowl this year, becoming the second major public policy group to skip the football championship game. The marketers of erectile dysfunction drugs Levitra and Cialis are also skipping the Super Bowl in what is apparently a move to lower the drug industry's advertising profile. The Super Bowl is as sought after by public policymakers as it is by marketers, though the broadcast networks have accepted few such ads. While the drug office's purchase of a Super Bowl spot has been expensive, last year's 30-second spot cost $2.25 million. The White House got a benefit that no other advertiser received. Media companies have to provide a free ad for every paid public service announcement. That's two ads for $2.25 million. What a deal! The Office of Drug Control Policy since 2002 has used the Super Bowl to unveil its most visible efforts, some of which have been controversial. two spots that broke in 5 months after the September 11th attacks, linked the purchase of illegal drugs to the funding of terrorism. Tom Riley, a spokesman for the Drug Office, attributed this year's decision to skip the Super Bowl to budget cuts. We think the Super Bowl is a great ad buy for us and a great co-viewing opportunity for parents and their children, Mr. Riley said. But our budget has been reduced. We've been forced to make some hard choices. Meanwhile, direct-to-consumer prescription drug advertisers are also largely skipping the Super Bowl this year amid worries that Congress will limit direct-to-consumer advertising following several notable drug recalls such as Vioxx. Last year, Cialis and Levitra were heavily advertised during the game. But apparently nobody complained about that. That's me talking. That's not me reading. That didn't get anybody fined. Daddy, what's a four-hour erection? Shh. Watch the game. And from Athletic Turf News, herbicide-tolerant turf grass gets a setback. Dayline Columbus, Ohio, even though the genetics are well understood and easy to select for, don't look for herbicide-tolerant grass anytime soon. Penn State's David Huff told the 38th Annual Ohio Turf Conference in Columbus. In 50 years, we probably will have it, Huff said. He specializes in turf grass breeding and genetics. According to Huff, it's not the ability to develop such grasses, but the problems of controlling their spread and fixing liability for any escape of genetically modified grass that are the short-term hurdles. A report published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences showed that gene flow from genetically modified plants occurred up to 13 miles away in just 1 year. Says Huff. No one realized it could travel that far. The fact that it is a one-year study concerns some. Also, an aberrantly high amount of modified material was found in the farthest area when compared to several other areas closer to but still outside the quarantine area. Gene stewardship is another concern. Part of the hubbub is that grasses are vegetatively propagated and their pollen can fly in the wind. They can hybridize with native plants. On golf courses, such grasses are typically mowed low and often, eliminating seed production, but different uses, weather, economics, a labor strike, or other reason might cause the property manager to let it go for a while. Many people question the urgency of releasing a genetically modified material that does not add food, fiber, or medicinal value to society. Yeah, many people ask that. Not many enough, I guess. Thought that occurs when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, a lot of people are aware that there are suspicions that Vice President Cheney has a heavy hand upon the policy wheel of the administration. But a few people realize that he rewrites oaths on the fly. We take you to Washington last Thursday, where Speaker of the House Denny Hastert is swearing in the Vice President. Listen closely.
Raise your hand. Richard Cheney, do solemnly swear.
I, Richard Cheney, do solemnly swear.
That I will defend and support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of my office.
And I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office.
On which I'm about to enter, so help me God.
On which I'm about to enter, so help me God.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mr. Vice President, for helping Speaker of the House Hastert, who didn't know, apparently, the words of the oath. Vice President had memorized them, you see, ladies and gentlemen, but I guess the Speaker of the House was just reading them. That's what we're told by the Washington Post. Anyway, even there, you can't argue with Dick Cheney. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. British government is encouraging the United States to set a deadline for withdrawing troops from Iraq. Giving a timetable would be an important political signal that we intend to leave Iraq, a well-placed source in the British government said. America knows it will have to deal with the issue soon. But wait, there's more. Much, much more. This is actually inside the bubble, but just barely. Fascinating story here. Testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in July 2003, about the rebuilding of Iraq, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Defense Secretary, then and now, think of it, told the story of Jumana Hanna, an Iraqi woman who had recently come to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad with a tale of her horrible torture at the hands of Saddam Hussein's regime. Ms. Hanna's tale, more than 2 years of imprisonment that included being subjected to electric shocks, repeatedly raped, and sexually assaulted, was unusual in that she was willing to name the Iraqi police officials who participated in her torture. Quote, information that is helping to root out Ba'athist policemen who routinely tortured and killed prisoners, unquote, Mr. Wolfowitz. Ms. Hanna's story, which 10 days before Wolfowitz's testimony had been the subject of a front-page article in the Washington Post, appears to have unraveled. Esquire magazine, in its January issue, published a lengthy article by a writer who was hired to help her produce a memoir saying that her account had all but fallen apart. And the Post has now published a follow-up article saying that Ms. Hanna, who was granted refugee status by United States officials on the basis of her claims of imprisonment, torture, and sexual abuse, quote, appears to have made false claims about her past, according to a fresh examination of her statements. It's fresh. We like it fresh. We don't like those stale examinations. Dateline Iraq, Dateline Baghdad, Knight Ridder newspapers report the United States is steadily losing ground to the Iraqi insurgency, according to every key military yardstick. You naysayers, what's the matter with you? A Knight Ridder analysis of U.S. government statistics shows that although through all the major turning points that raised hopes of peace in Iraq, including the arrest of Saddam Hussein and the handover of sovereignty at the end of June, the insurgency has become deadlier and more effective. The analysis suggests that unless something dramatic changes, such as a newfound will by Iraqis to reject the insurgency or a large escalation of U.S. troop strength, the United States will not win the war. Unfavorable trends, U.S. military fatalities from hostile acts have risen from an average of about 17 per month just after mission accomplished to an average of 82 a month. The average number of U.S. soldiers wounded by hostile acts per month has spiraled from 142 to 808. Attacks on the coalition have risen from 735 a month to 2,400. The average number of mass casualty bombings has grown from 0 to 13 a month. Electricity production is below pre-war average. Iraq is pumping 500,000 barrels a day of oil fewer than its pre-war peak. All the trend lines we can identify are in the wrong direction, said Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. Well, they're liberals. What do you want? Numbers. It's not a number. As we reported last week, ladies and gentlemen, the administration's new suggestion is it's not a numbers game. Don't use numbers. Of course, numbers were in the vocabulary of this administration. The metrics by which we judge things back when we were going to judge. From over the pond, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has reportedly drawn up Britain's case against a military strike on Iran, amid fears that we might do that. Straw has produced a 200-page dossier that rules out military action and made the case for a negotiated solution to thwart Iran's suspected ambition to produce nuclear weapons. This is according to the Rupert Murdoch-owned London Sunday Times. He said a peaceful solution led by Britain, France, and Germany, old Europe, was in the best interests of Iran and the international community. The dossier was quietly issued in Britain's parliament on the eve of Bush's inauguration for fear of provoking a public rift with Washington. However, according to the Times of London, privately, tensions are running high between the U.S. and the United Kingdom over that. Say goodbye to the Coalition of the Willing. The White House has done away with the list of Iraq allies known as the Coalition of the Willing, which Washington used to back its argument that the invasion was a multilateral action. This was revealed on Friday. The senior administration official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, we know that, said the White House replaced the coalition list with a smaller roster of 28 countries with troops in Iraq sometime after the June transfer of sovereignty. We're just learning about it now. The official could not say when or why the administration did away with the list of the Coalition of the Willing, the COW. Oh, no, that spells cow. We can't. Costa Rica withdrew last September under pressure from voters. On Friday, an organization from Iceland published a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for its country's withdrawal from the coalition and offering apologies for its support for U.S. policy. Ukraine is pulling out after their little exercise in democracy. Colin Powell says he would like to see U.S. troops leave Iraq as quickly as possible, but that the strength of the insurgency does not allow the Bush administration to set a time frame for withdrawal this year. It's not possible right now to say that by the end of 2005 we'll be down to such and such a number. It really is dependent upon the situation. He said, referring to the training of the new Iraqi army and police, isn't that the job that Bernard Kerik went over to do? Yeah. He did it fine. President Bush's inauguration speech, saying the United States will promote the growth of democratic movements and institutions worldwide, is at odds with the administration's increasingly close relations with repressive governments in every corner of the world, says an analysis by the Washington Post. Some of the administration allies in the war on terrorism, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Uzbekistan, are ranked by the State Department as among the worst abusers of human rights on the planet. Hey, that's just our planet. That's a numbers game. We don't want to play that. From an Australian newspaper also owned by Rupert Murdoch, outgoing Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage says regarding Iraq, I'm disappointed that Iraq hasn't turned out better and that we weren't able to move forward more meaningfully in the Middle East peace process. This Armitage is leaving along with his boss, Powell. After a minute's pause, he adds another regret. The biggest regret is that we didn't stop 9/11, and then in the wake of 9/11, instead of redoubling what is our traditional export of hope and optimism, we exported our fear and our anger and presented a very intense and angry face to the world. I regret that a lot, unquote, outgoing Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. Apropos of the president's speech about bringing democracy to the world, says a senior White House aide, who spoke on condition of anonymity, quote, unless we get Iraq straightened out and quick, anything else we try is futile. There's some soaring rhetoric for you. But ladies and gentlemen, the Bernie Kerik story does not stop there. Oh, I'm just pausing to look at stuff. Don't worry about me. I'm still here. The Bernie Kerik story includes this. First of all, Dateline Washington, the retired four-star Army General Luck, we talked about him, who is sent to Iraq to assess operations there, has concluded that American troops must speed up and strengthen the training of Iraqi security forces by assigning thousands of additional military advisors to work directly with Iraqi units. Again, that was the job that Bernie Kerik did such a good job at that he only stayed 3 of his originally estimated 18 months in Iraq. Because he was training the police and security forces. And bang, bang, baby. But he has had his accountability moment as well. Kerik, whose nomination as Homeland Security Chief collapsed in a scandal storm, was invited to the inauguration and was expected to attend. We don't know whether he actually did. Kerik was invited to the swearing-in, to the inaugural parade, and to an inaugural ball, according to the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post. Why am I quoting Rupert's paper so much? Gosh, what's the problem? What's the problem with you other guys? You other evil owners, press lords. A senior Republican strategist said Kerik deserves the invites for going to Iraq at Bush's request to help rebuild its police force and working all out for the president's election. Yeah, which of those two do you think was the motive force in the reward? Quote, he was somebody who worked tirelessly to reelect the president, went above and beyond the call, he said. It would be wonderful if he'd come and join the inaugural festivities because he worked so hard to reelect the president. Kerik also was invited to a private inaugural party being hosted by his ex-boss, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani and Giuliani Partners. He's his ex-boss because after Kerik's nomination for Homeland Security Chief collapsed, Giuliani suggested that Kerik not be one of Giuliani Partners anymore. And yet, there he is.
When New York needed correcting, Kerik was there. With a countenance just as grim as a cleric's stare. When his house, it needed fixing, there was no money, he was Nixon. When the mobsters would mix in, Kerik was there.
Kerik was there.
When the city was on fire, Kerik was there. Taking time out only for a torrid affair, just to make a good impression, he used a flat meant for decompression of the guys in his profession. Kerik was there.
Kerik was there.
Kerik was there.
Kerik was there.
Kerik was there. When Mayor Rudy had his passion, Kerik was there. When the time had come to cash in, when Iraq needed policing, Kerik was there. Though some said it was a fleecing, could Kerik care? It was 3 long months of training, then the crap, it started raining. So without complaining, Kerik was out of there. When Homeland needed securing, Kerik was there. But his nanny records were found in disrepair. So Bernie took a powder before the questioning got louder. On the pages of the tabloids, Kerik was there, was there. When Bush did his re-swearing, Kerik was there. Tickets to the balls, he had more than his share. About him just smell big. Is he rogue or is he zealot? Everywhere except in Rudy's hair, Kerik is there.
Kerik is there.
Kerik is there.
Kerik
Carrick is there.
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 Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The apologies bin runneth over this week. Ketchum Public Relations, a big public relations company, hence the name, has apologized for paying a company owned by the conservative commentator Armstrong Williams to promote the Bush administration's educational policies. The agency also promised to change its policies to prevent another such lapse in judgment. Dateline Melbourne, Australia, Argentina's Juan Ignacio Chela apologized for spitting at Australian tennis player Leighton Hewitt in a spiteful end to the third round at the Australian Open on Saturday. Hewitt won the match, but the result was overshadowed by the on-court drama as tensions threatened to boil over in the fourth set. Chandler became irritated by Hewitt's antics whenever he won a big point, and after the Australian appeared to swear at him, the Argentinian spat in Hewitt's direction. The Argentine later admitted he did spit, but said it was not aimed at Hewitt. However, he said he apologized anyway. Deadline Raleigh, North Carolina, the Secretary of Crime Control and Public Safety is using words like surprised and disappointed. He says he's never known of a county to refuse a request from the governor, but the state said that happened. This week, the state believes commuters stranded by the winter weather should have had someplace to go. When the county did not offer any shelter, state emergency officials called the county and asked leaders to open shelters. Says Joe Bryan, chairman of the Wake County Commissioners, said he will make sure the governor is not put on hold, which was what happened when he called to get the shelters open. I would like to apologize to the governor, Bryan said. In the run-up to the Iraq War, oh no, this is not an apology. Dateline Washington, the performers at Tuesday's inaugural youth concert. Sorry, yes, Tuesday's, the first one in the series. Most of them were Thursday, but this was Tuesday. Beating the Rush. This was the youth concert. They were Republican-approved, these performers, and purposely PG-rated, but one band strayed from the script. Quote, "Welcome to the greatest expletive country in the world," said lead singer of Fuel, Brett Scallions. Realizing his mistake, he quickly corrected course. "I wasn't supposed to use that word. I apologize," he said. The name again? Brett Scallions, ladies and gentlemen. This is the real world. This isn't Hollywood. Tsunami, which is a product that was designed using a surfing theme, has recently come into the spotlight because of the tragic events in Southeast Asia. When asked whether the product was being continued, here was the official result from PepsiCo, which produces it. Quote, "The overwhelming and tragic devastation caused by tsunamis in Southeast Asia defies imagination. Our hearts and prayers are with the victims. We apologize if the name of our tsunami beverage, which was introduced nearly 5 years ago, now appears insensitive. Please be sure that we share your passion and desire to help those in critical need." Dateline Dayton, Ohio. The appearance of the University of Dayton mascot, Rudy Flyer, on the pages of Playboy.com's website has prompted an apology from the athletic director of the private Catholic university. "We made a mistake and I apologize for it," said Ted Kissel, who had not been aware that the department's marketing people had given the go-ahead for the Playboy.com interview. "I apologize," he said, "to anyone who might be offended." Liza Minnelli's lawyers are troubled by a Scottish ad for a new kind of potato that features a doctored image of the entertainer. Hey, you'd think she'd be grateful for a doctored image at this point. But I digress. Signet Potato Breeders of Scotland recently launched the Cabaret Potato, named in tribute to Minnelli, and advertised the new spud with a photo of the singer that featured two fried French fries in place of her legs. The ad ran in a trade magazine, the magazine of the National Federation of Fish Friers, which has a circulation of 2,500. Minnelli's New York lawyers quickly became concerned, although they have yet to file any legal action. Meanwhile, Signet's managing director, Douglas Harley, said, quote, "If Minnelli has been offended by our advertisement for our cabaret potatoes, I do apologize. This was never meant to have caused upset." Hey, imagine the vegetable that would be named after David Guest, her ex-husband. But I digress. You know about the Iceland ad where group of protesters are apologizing for their country's support of the Iraq War. So let's move quickly to Sure West Communications around Sacramento. Said a contractor handling its electronic bill payment program mistakenly drew a total of $50,000 from the accounts of 350 former and current customers. The contractor, which Sure West officials have declined to identify, combined a small current computer file with one or more different older computer files before making routine debits. "We regret that this occurred at all, but it seems to be limited to our broadband unit and only a small percentage of our customers." However, some customers affected by the billing mistake said they were not broadband customers. Go figure. Sure, that's why it's called Sure West, because they're not. The Doan College recruiting postcard proved a bit too suggestive, mailed to thousands of California high school students by the private college in Crete, Nebraska. One frame showed a student playing football. A caption said he had found a place where he could work toward a career, quote, "and also play the field," unquote. The next frame featured the student talking with attractive women. The card said, quote, and play the field some more, unquote. Criticized for objectifying women and sending a poor message about the school, Doan stopped the marketing campaign and apologized to anyone, quote, in any way offended. They reject the characterization of their school as a bunch of cretins, however. Crete, Nebraska. You see what I'm saying? The New York Post reports that celebrity chef Rocco DiSpirito of the late lamented NBC reality series The Restaurant used the F-word on the air on his WOR food show this week. Said station manager Bob Bruno, it was an unfortunate slip of the tongue, and he apologized profusely for it. Dateline Miami, a federal air marshal detained and questioned Argentina's foreign minister last week at Miami International Airport. An episode touched off by a four-hour flight delay in New York. The State Department has apologized and investigating the events involving Argentine Foreign Minister Rafael Bielsa. He did not spit at the people who... Dateline Cambridge, Massachusetts. Harvard University President Lawrence Summers issued his third apology last week for remarks he made that scholars in the U.S. said was a message that women lack the ability to excel at math and science. In his latest statement, the 50-year-old former U.S. Treasury Secretary apologized for the comments made at an economic conference while denying he made them. Quote, I was wrong to have spoken in a way that has resulted in an unintended signal of discouragement to talented girls and women. Despite reports to the contrary, I did not say and I do not believe that girls are intellectually less able than boys or that women lack the ability to succeed at the highest levels of science. Boston Globe had reported that Summers said in his conference remarks that women don't have the same innate ability in math and science as men. J.P. Morgan accepted thousands of slaves as collateral. Not J.P. Morgan, a predecessor bank. The admission is part of an apology sent to J.P. Morgan staff after the bank researched its links to slavery in order to meet legislation in Chicago. On Sunday, something was said on the red carpet regarding Dakota Fanning. E! Networks would like viewers to know that this insensitive comment was not true and it was spoken in jest. We apologize to Dakota and her family for any misunderstanding. She's a 10-year-old actress, ladies and gentlemen, in case you're wondering. The bishops of the Episcopal Church formally apologized this week for the pain, hurt, and damage caused by the consecration of an openly gay bishop, but stopped short of saying the action was wrong. Yeah, the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. I told you there were a lot of them. So, the president's inauguration speech. Bold words. Soaring rhetoric. We will bend our efforts to help democracy. Our enemy now is tyranny. No mention of terrorism, no mention of Iraq in the entire speech. And as noted earlier, some of our, at least at the present time, closest allies would seem to be in the crosshairs, although less than a full day after the speech, White House briefers were, shall we say, avid to issue, shall we say, updates indicating that, shall we say, the speech indicated no change in policy. Meanwhile, maybe the phone lines were sizzling.
Liberating Eagle. Hey. 43, guess Secret Service heard the speech. 41, they sure did. You and Mom have a good time?
Oh, had a great time. Barr said Laura never looked prettier.
Yeah, she told me.
Barr?
Laura. Huh? She also said you said she's beginning to look like Nancy Reagan.
In a good way. You know, which, of course, is the only way to look like Nancy Reagan.
Well,
the old Nancy Reagan, you know, yeah. when she was first lady, not since she became
the elderly Nancy Reagan.
Well, anyway, beautiful inauguration.
Yeah, thanks.
Nice to see the family actually getting along.
Yeah, that was a relief.
Well, gotta be on best behavior sometime.
Good trip back?
No problem. Never realized there was an Air Force 12.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I kind of realized after you guys beat it out of here, you never said what you thought about the speech.
That's right.
Because?
I mean, maybe I'm missing something here, but, you know, does a guy's son give a second inauguration speech throwing down a generational challenge every other year or something? I mean, it's kind of a big deal for me.
I realize that. Didn't want to rain on your parade is all.
Well,
figured if you wanted to know, you'd ask me.
Okay. Well, consider yourself the askee.
Well, Sprout, know that you pledged not to repeat what you think of as my mistakes.
Well, gee, let's see here now. I haven't raised taxes. Uh-huh. I haven't failed to take down Mr. Hussein. Uh-huh. Somehow I got reelected. So, yeah, I guess you'd have to say, so far, so-so.
Uh-huh. Remember you always gave me grief about supposedly not having the vision thing.
Yeah, me and about 50 million of your fellow and gal Americans.
Just seems like you couldn't bend over more backwards if you tried.
Oh, now look, I was standing straight up. I practiced that speech to the mirror for a solid week.
No. I mean, geez, that's vision enough thing for three presidents and a psychic.
Well,
you know, words have consequences. Your own Mr. Bartlett said you have a new realization of that after your first term.
Yeah, I don't know what he meant by that.
Well, but 43, you know, second term, you're going to spend a lot of time meeting with these international fellas, Mr. Putin,
yeah.
Various kings and potentates, who I've always thought of as our friends in the Middle East, along with Israel, of course.
Uh-huh.
Not to mention our Chinese associates. What are they supposed to be thinking as they sit across the table from you?
Hey, 43, they're reading all the follow-up statements from us that the speech doesn't mean a policy shiftization, you know?
Mm.
This isn't a threat to them. It's right in the speech itself. This is a generational challenge. So, you know, I'll be long gone before they have anything to worry about.
Probably true, but...
But every once in a while, you know, I don't think it's hurtful to reassertionalize the values this country was founded on.
Well, if you're talking about the founders, they thought that we should be an example to the world, not going out and actually trying to change it ourselves.
Yeah, those founders. But the later founders, they sure didn't throw a more muscular foreign policy out of bed, did they? And you know, maybe it's okay if Pooty Poot thinks we've maybe got some of our new Pentagon secret ops happening under his nose. Might just, you know, result in a better deal for his petroleum resources.
Look, an end to tyranny on Earth. I mean, okay, let's say I'm living in Uzbekistan. What am I supposed to think when you make that speech and then you come visit the guy who put me in jail?
What'd you do wrong?
No, for being a dissenter.
Well, Ashcroft did that. What's he supposed to think?
You're not visiting him. You're visiting this tyrant. His people see that and they think...
You know what, 41? I'm going to say this flat out, so pardon my Frenchiness, but...
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to think anything worse about me than...
Here we go. Then the Iraqis we encouraged to rise up against Saddam in 91 and then didn't support. Think about me.
Hey, if the shoe fits, walk a mile in it.
Just seemed a little overreachy and preachy.
Preachy? Heck, we took most of the really biblical stuff out. Look, sir, I know this is... It's probably the most sensitive, sore spot still between us.
Assuming I've forgiven you for wrecking the El Dorado, which I have.
But, you know, Condi and I felt, okay, we've gone negative on the foreign front for long enough. You know, yes, we're against global terror.
Hmm.
But what the heck are we for, you know? Well, if the terrorists hate freedom, and we know that because we've already said it, then that's what we're for. So now we're going positive, and now whatever we do abroad happens under that umbrella of optimism. That's Gerson's line, man. He's a great wordster.
Just think, if you're going to tick off a member of the Saudi royals, you better get something more for it than a pretty speech. And you know, they look at us and see that Colin and his people are gone.
Oh, look, Colin was a good man. Times change. Presidents outgrow their training wheels. But 41, I asked for your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I value it. Mm-hmm. I thank you for sharing it.
Well.
And you know, let's let that dog go back to sleep. What do you say?
You're the doctor.
No, sir, but I'm the president, and that's good enough. You give my love to Mom.
Will do. Tell Laura...
I know, not to lose any more weight. Yeah. You take care, 41.
Congratulations again, 43.
Yeah.
¶¶
Ladies and gentlemen, catching up on some other news of the week. Final report came out this week on what went wrong with the exit polls in the 2004 United States elections. Anderson Mitofsky, the company that does the exit polling, released this report. The error rate was smaller in precincts where the interviewers attempted to survey every voter. Error rates went up in larger precincts where interviewers surveyed every third or every tenth voter. Let's say it together. Duh. Error rates were higher in swing precincts, those that had approximately equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. Older interviewers had smaller error rates than younger interviewers. Yeah. And error rates went up significantly if interviewers were required to stand 100 feet away from the polling place. The report conclusions, when they had greater discretion in swing precincts and in larger precincts where they couldn't interview everyone, younger interviewers unconsciously tended to select younger voters who were more likely to have voted for Kerry. My conclusion, a little simpler. When you come out of a voting booth and somebody asks you how you voted, tell them it's none of their business. Meanwhile, in Great Britain, what a nutty coincidence. They got soldiers being court-martialed for incidents of abuse of Iraqi prisoners depicted in shocking and appalling photographs, according to the prosecution at the court-martial. The British soldiers forced Iraqis to strip bare and simulate oral and anal sex. Where'd they get that idea? No, they just made it up, just like the guys from West Virginia. This is a nutty coincidence, isn't it? There were also pictures of a grimacing Iraqi who had been strung up in a cargo net made from thick rope which had been hung from a forklift truck. Well, now that's original. Another showed a soldier wearing just shorts and flip-flops standing on an Iraqi man who was crouched in a fetal position on the ground. Just happens that way. Our intelligence agency made the same mistakes British intelligence made before the war, and our troops made the same mistake their troops made after the war. It's just the bond we have. By the way, the one difference in the case of the court-martial of Specialist Grainer, who's doing 10 years hard for his role at Abu Ghraib, the presiding judge of the court-martial did not allow any evidence that Grainer's superiors, as he claimed in his defense, had encouraged him to do what he did. In the British trial, the officer who ordered the illegal operation that resulted in British soldiers allegedly abusing and sexually humiliating Iraqi prisoners, that evidence has been allowed in court, but that officer, was exonerated 10 days before this court-martial. Because, his name is Major Taylor, because his superior officer authorized him to give the command, you see. The commander was found guilty of nothing more than well-meaning but misguided zeal. This court-martial continues, of course. And my favorite detail of the story so far, several of the British soldiers told Iraqi prisoners to drink urine. They were made to clean out latrines with their bare hands and told to dance like Michael Jackson. Coincidentally, the chief of the defense staff of the British defense establishment, Major General Sir Michael Jackson. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America on WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network, around the world via your computer at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, on channel 108 on Sirius Satellite Radio several times every week, and available as a free download at audible.com/theshow. It'll be just like dancing like Michael Jackson if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. A tip at Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. And to Bob Dunn at WWL-TV here in New Orleans, Louisiana, for making today's broadcast a broadcast. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.